The Guardian.
Hello, I'm Hugh Muir. Coming up on Politics Weekly, they're in government, but are they also in trouble? The Lib Dems head for summer conference, needing a boost in morale and a big boost in the polls. As the party leader backs nuclear power, tuition fees and fracking, will anyone in Glasgow agree with Nick? And after 4 days of the TUC in Bournemouth, what's the future for the union movement? Is it curtains for the unions and the Labour Party? Or will the two sides reach a deal? And mind your language.
You've lied to the people of London in your...
Oh, get stuck.
The Mayor of London loses the plot, muttering foul oaths at a protester and telling a fellow politician to shove it. What happens when politicos go bad? And joining me for this week's scrap, two falls and one submission decides the winner, a Guardian columnist Seamus Milne, our leader writer Anne Perkins, and from the estimable website Liberal Democrat Voice, the editor Stephen Tall. Thank you all for coming, and I know you'll be on your best behaviour. Let's start with the Lib Dems, because the party's conference in Glasgow could be a lively one. Nick Clegg's intention to embrace nuclear power, tuition fees, a limited replacement for Trident and fracking represents a bit of a shift. And all this in the wake of the departure of the Lib Dem MP for Brent, Sarah Tether, due to disagreements with Nick Clegg over immigration and welfare. Stephen Tall, let me start with you. Serious situation, really. I think the YouGov poll that we saw earlier in the week talked about the party being on about 9%. Nick Clegg being on a staggering minus 58% in terms of his approval rating. What to do?
Well, the only way is up, clearly. I think it's what you're seeing at conference is two things. One, incredibly packed programme, so almost certainly going to be a leadership defeat somewhere along the line because all the issues you've mentioned are controversial internally. And then secondly, you've got the fact that the party's gearing up for a second general election and possibly a second coalition, which means that people are starting to limber up. What's going to be in the manifesto, what's not? Is the social liberal wing of the party going to get its own back on Nick Clegg dragging the party to what they see as the right? Will Osborneomics be defeated? So you've got big issues coming up for play. I think what you're seeing is a leadership that is frustrated with its activists, thinking that they've not, quote, grown up enough, and activists saying, just a moment, we're the ones losing our seats in droves in the town halls around the country, and we want a bit more credit from you for that. So I think both sides getting a bit grumpy with each other, and that's going to play out next week.
What does it mean for you when you're on the doorsteps and you're trying to persuade good people to vote Liberal Democrat? When they say, what do you stand for, what do you say?
That's the key question. And the party will point to its policies implemented in government, whether that's the pupil premium, whether that's tax cuts for the low paid. The question is that cutting through? If the next election is going to be a living standards election, will people feel that actually the Lib Dems have done anything for them? Do they feel better off than they did 5 years ago? That's going to be the key question. One of the debates up in Glasgow next week is about whether there should be a living wage. I suspect that will go through. You are seeing more of an emphasis. There's also push for greater tax cuts, so actually meaning that anyone paid up to the minimum wage won't pay income tax at all. So that's up to £12,500, an expensive pledge. How does it get paid for? That's where the mansion tax comes in, Vince Cable's fabled mansion tax that he's still trying to push. So all these kind of issues are building up, and the big debate is the Monday economy debate, and that's where you will see some amendments put to the leadership. It's interesting the leadership's not really going to the wire on it as much as they might have done. They seem to be kind of sitting back a bit because they reckon that if they're the ones, it's Nick Clegg leading from the front too far, then activists are going to want to give him a bloody nose. So I think they're trying to take a bit more of a laissez-faire approach, not just to the economics, but also to the party management.
Seamus Milne, your fellow columnist Martin Kettle, wrote a piece this week saying that although it looks bad for the Liberal Democrats, he has a hunch that they're going to be OK. I mean, looking at it from the outside, do you think they're going to be OK?
Well, he was basing a lot of that on the Eastleigh by-election.
And a hunch,
yeah. And I think he's probably right that the Lib Dems are not going to do as badly as it sometimes appeared during this Parliament. But obviously it depends what happens in the next year or two. And as Stephen said, the living standards issue is absolutely crucial. If people's living standards are still falling, as they have been year after year, come the election, then I think it's going to be very hard for either of the coalition parties, despite all Ed Miliband and Labour's problems of the last few weeks. I think it's also interesting, as Stephen said, you know, Liberal Democrat conferences are always lively because they still do have real votes, which largely disappeared over the last 20 years in the other two
So it's a proper conference.
You have real debates and real votes, and sometimes leadership gets defeated and that actually affects things. Although I think if Nick Clegg would have his way, that would happen less and less. I think there's also an interesting split opening up or difference opening up, which is shown by the differing attitudes towards the Labour Party and the Labour leadership by different wings of the Liberal Democrats. So we've seen Jeremy Brown saying that the Labour leadership's hopeless and a complete vacuum, and Tim Farron today saying he likes Ed Miliband, thinks he's a good guy. And so there's obviously the two sides of the Liberal Democrat family have got different ideas about what might happen after the election and whether Nick Clegg could be a potential casualty of that process, especially if Labour were to become the largest party, is an interesting question. And I think we'll see some signals about that this week.
And as Seamus was saying, the Lib Dem conference can be quite rumbustious. If you were Nick Clegg, God forbid, how would you play it?
I think, as Stephen was hinting, you know, the leadership's got to feel the delegates' pain, and particularly the loss of the council seats, which really, really hurts. All those years of hard work to get in and get control of councils, and now suddenly they've got no power at all. I mean, one thing to be sacked from your ministerial job after a long, you know, years of brown-nosing at Westminster, but something else altogether to lose control of your council. I was really interested listening to Stephen, actually, because I've read Martin this week and also Raphael Baer and The Statesman, and they're very much coming at it from a Westminster perspective. And Westminster feels quite kind of bullish, I think. Westminster feels that, you know, they've kind of worked out how to make coalition work and the worst is over, and, you know, they've got some distinctive policies and they're beginning to frame an identity in the context of coalition, all of which kind of shores up their decision in the first place to go in to join a coalition. And I think the voice from the constituencies is going to be quite different, and they're going to have, I think, quite a sharp wake-up call, aren't they?
Yeah.
But Sting, does it cut no ice with the membership to have this argument that, look, we weren't in government for years and years and years, and now we are, but there are things that come with that. There are prices that you pay. You talked about the leadership hoping that people would grow up. They must be very frustrated.
Yes, I think they are. On Lib Dem Voice, we poll party members regularly, and 73% in our last poll said they wanted to stay in government in some way after the next election. I mean, the prize for the Lib Dems is huge there, because suddenly, if there were a second coalition, either with Conservatives or Labour, Lib Dems are looking at having had a decade in power. That would have been absolutely unthinkable even 3 years, 4 years ago, the idea that the Lib Dems would have 10 years to influence government. So I think people are still excited by that side of things. Of course, what you then get is those people who would rather have a second coalition with Conservatives versus those who would, the 2-to-1 majority, those who would prefer to go in with Labour next time. And then that comes back to the issue of, is there enough room for agreement with Labour? We know that there hasn't been with Conservatives, as they've been dragged to the right by their querulous backbenchers. Will Labour actually make ground on the issues that matter most to Lib Dems? So civil liberties, for example. There's been huge tensions with the Conservatives over things like secret court, the detention of David Miranda. Those kind of issues matter a lot to Lib Dems, but of course Labour's not making much of the running there either. And in fact, they started it all with authoritarian Home Secretaries like David Blunkett and Jack Straw. So is there really a better deal out there? Plus the fact that next time, chances are we will have fewer MPs. How many fewer we'll see, but fewer MPs. So we won't be in quite the same post-Clegmania kind of style strength to be able to negotiate a second coalition agreement that gives us even more in second coalition.
Well, one's sure that as a proper conference, there'll be a whole range of issues discussed on the floor and in the fringe meetings. And here's one, because the Lib Dems are the only major party without any minority MPs. Given the recent research indicating that 168 marginal seats could be decided by the minority electorate, this seems rather strange. Now, one of the authors of the Operation Black Vote research that all the parties have been looking at was Lester Holloway, who's actually a Liberal Democrat councillor and secretary of the Ethnic Minority Liberal Democrats group. Earlier, I spoke to Lester and asked him what he thought the party should be doing.
I think that we are making efforts now, but they need to be increased many-fold. I mean, what's happening now is that the Liberal Democrats have an A-list of the candidate leadership program participants, which are people of all underrepresented groups, black and ethnic minorities, women, there's a socioeconomic category, disabilities, and so on. And they are given extra mentoring and polished up And also offered extra opportunities to go for target seats. There are reserved places on short lists of target seats for participants. However, it's not enough. We could still go a lot further. The group in which I'm involved in, an affiliated group to the Liberal Democrats called the Ethnic Minority Liberal Democrats, have been pushing for some time for changes to the selection procedure, or more changes to the selection procedure, to give a greater opportunity to black and Asian candidates. So far, we haven't won that argument within the party, but I think that that argument still continues. And we have to remember as well that before the last election, Nick Clegg himself said, when giving evidence to the Speaker's inquiry into underrepresentation, that if the party had not made progress by the election after next, then he would even consider the idea of all black shortlists.
Are you going to hold him to that?
If we emerge from the next election without a single MP from a minority community, then I think that that is words which will continue to come back and haunt him. But really, it's not ultimately his decision. I think that something like that would have to be endorsed and ratified by the party at party conferences. And so, you know, even if, you know, in the unlikely event of him proposing it, there's no guarantee whatsoever that the party would wear it. So that's why the debates that we're having within the party are so crucial, because there's also a process of education that's involved as well, where we're actually saying to the party, look, it's no good just wishing for greater diversity. You actually have to do something. And although we are doing some things, you know, I'm not convinced by any means that it's going to be nearly enough.
Just quickly, you've been talking about the seat in Brent. Sarah Tethers obviously said that she's going to stand down. Your strong feeling is that they must find a minority candidate for that seat.
Yes, and it's not because I believe that you know, multicultural seats must inevitably have a black or an Asian candidate. I've never been of that view, but I think that with the Liberal Democrats and where we are now, you know, we face a particular challenge because we don't have you know, any, you know, black or ethnic minority representation at the moment. We've got to seize these opportunities, and so while sort of generally, you know, I believe that you know, black candidates are, you know, good candidates, you know, in any constituency, no matter how diverse or undiverse, and clearly, you know, there are many good white MPs both now and in the past as well, who've represented all communities and spoken up about the issues of race equality as good as anyone. However, you know, we need to right now seize these kind of opportunities in Brent Central. I do believe there are going to be you know, black and Asian candidates putting themselves forward for the selection procedure, and we'll have to see what happens. But I certainly wrote a blog the other day, which was published in a Wembley publication, which was arguing for the Liberal Democrats selecting, as you say, a black or an Asian candidate for that seat.
Lester Holloway, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
So, Stephen, that's what Lester thinks. Obviously, the party has a lot of other issues on its plate as well. So is this one important?
Oh, yeah, it's definitely important that the Lib Dems, like any political party, has to look like the population at large, and we don't currently. The lack of any black or ethnic minority MPs is bad for the party. So is the lack of women MPs as well, 7 out of 57 only, and a number of those in marginal seats that are dodgy for the next election. So the party has got a real problem that it doesn't just look like it's white and middle class and middle aged. It's true of lots of parties, but it's certainly true of the Lib Dems in droves, and that's partly because we're a party that doesn't like to have any kind of central diktat. So the idea that from the centre you can have an A-list or parachute in a leadership programme candidate makes it really tricky then to be able to deliver on that kind of representation. Plus the fact that the Lib Dems just don't have safe seats. I mean, apart from in places like the Highlands of Scotland, it's not something you can easily correct by just saying, we're going to have a quota, because you can't guarantee that that quota will actually turn out next time. At the last election, in the 8 top targets for the Lib Dems, 4 of them had female candidates, and I think only one or perhaps none at all got elected.
Yeah. And Nick Clegg talked about breaking the logjam if he had to, or at least looking after the 2015 election if there were no minority MPs, at maybe having all minority shortlists. Is that something that you think he could sell?
I think it would be tough, but I also think there is actually, over my now quite long career covering politics has been such a shift in understanding, actually, of what has to be done in order to change the makeup of elected bodies, and how hard it is to allow the tendency of selection groups, whatever they are, to select people like themselves, and the need, as Nick Clegg himself has said, to break it up by some kind of external means. I think even though it goes absolutely to the against the grain of every Liberal Democrat, I think there's a much wider acceptance now that in certain circumstances and for a limited time, it's absolutely essential. I mean, the Conservatives now buy into it, you know, which is phenomenal. I mean, for Liberals to be behind the Conservatives on something like this is not a good place for them to be.
Shame is everyone is struggling with this, and all the major parties are struggling with minority representation in one way or another.
Well, it's also, I think, an issue about class, really, because, you know, why do the Lib Dems struggle on this issue? Because it's an overwhelmingly middle-class party, and most people from minority ethnic groups are not. In fact, most of the population are not. And most of the population, as we were reminded by the British Social Attitude Survey this week, regard themselves as working class, even though you'd never know that from the way these issues, politics is covered. So I think, you know, there's a wider problem, not only about the mechanisms about how selection is made, but about the, you know, the absence of the majority of the population from mainstream politics, and the problem we've had growing over recent years of more and more of a narrow professional political elite dominating the political process. And so I think that's what has to be bust open first and foremost, and that would then create the conditions for a real breakthrough on, you know, making politics more like Britain.
So maybe all working class shortlists.
Well, that comes to what's happening in the Labour Party at the moment, which is, you know, partly reflects the fact that compared with 30 or 40 years ago, the number of MPs, of Labour MPs, and even more from other parties from working class backgrounds, is absolutely tiny in Parliament. And, you know, that just is a, I mean, it's a crisis, reflects a crisis of political representation that, you know, the largest section of the population is not represented really in Parliament.
And a crisis of working class organisation?
Of course, and that comes down to the issue of what's happened in the economy and the trade unions over the last generation. And that's part of the, I mean, it really does, it goes to the heart of what this battle about is at the moment in the Labour Party.
We used to have two training grounds for future MPs. One was the town hall and one was trade union movement. And both of those now are gradually diminishing. Town halls have been stripped of their powers over decades, so why would you stand for the local council anymore? And obviously the trade union movement is a shadow of its former self. So both of those entry routes for people have been taken away, and what you've ended up with, of course, is the kind of internship and SPAD route in as well, which means that you tend to have a much more middle-class population. So the trouble with when you talk about female and black and ethnic minority representation is, do you want a black middle-class solicitor or a white bus driver? You know, it's those kinds of issues that actually get beyond the kind of simple quota argument to actually how do you get something that's representative of the population without it being a tick box exercise.
So that's something the Lib Dems will be grappling with over the weekend. And if you want to keep up with our coverage of their conference, you can do that on theguardian.com/politics. So that was the conference to come. Let's talk a bit about the conference just ended, the TUC. It was a tough gig with Ed Miliband. He said the right things, railing against 0 hours contracts, promising no more free schools, and making the right noises about the railways. His speech was heard in polite silence, but given the roasting he could have had, that was a bit of a triumph. Bob Crowe, leader of the RMT union, said Ed looked like a terrified rabbit caught in the glare of Tory headlights. Len McCluskey, by contrast, the Unite General Secretary, said the speech was the work of a real leader. Now, Seamus, you were there. Which of them's closest to the truth?
Well, he was listened to in with respect, but not with much enthusiasm, I think. And that's not just because of the row about trade unions' links with the Labour Party. I think it's also because, particularly on the issue of the economy and austerity, there is a lot of anxiety in the trade union movement about what Labour appears to be signing up to, which is hedged about a bit, but already is pretty clearly the current spending limits for the first year of the next parliament that the coalition has already set, i.e. signing up to George Osborne's plans for 2015-16. And especially in the public sector, trade union members are losing income and living standards like everybody else, but directly as a result of that programme. And because Labour supported the 1% pay cap on incomes in the public sector, on wages in the public sector, you know, that's a very direct decision that impacts on those people. So I think there's a lot of scepticism about where the Miliband Ball's leadership is taking the Labour Party on the economy, on the crucial issues of the economy. So I think that accounts for a lot of the lack of enthusiasm.
So in terms of that relationship, is it just that they know where he's going and they don't like it, or is it they really don't know where he's going?
I think they want a lot more enthusing, not only of themselves, but of the people that they represent in the country, with clear policies that spell out a different direction and an alternative to the current austerity programme of the coalition. And I think they don't feel they're getting that. But on the other hand, there is warmth towards Ed Miliband for the similar reasons to what Tim Farron has been saying today, that he's a progressive guy and people can see that. He's different from the Blairite New Labour generation. But the problem, I think the feeling is he's not different enough. And of course, it's followed a summer of internal backbiting among often former bigwigs from the New Labour era against Miliband and his leadership. And that's obviously shown up in the opinion polls to some extent, where the public has seen that, you know, he hasn't got the full confidence of the team around him. And so that's obviously also a problem.
And does he benefit, Ed Miliband, from having a bit of a scrap with the unions, do you think?
Well, I don't think he benefits at all from the way it was reported the day after, when he was, you know, the splash headlines and some papers were that he had bottled out, and that just kind of fed straight into the narrative, and Cameron made a great deal of it at Prime Minister's Questions on Wednesday. Well, I mean, personally, I think that if he's going to change the nature of the link with individual members who affiliate through the trade unions, then it seems to me that he's also going to have to do something that demonstrates a change in the nature of the trade union's role at conference and in elections. Now, I know Seamus can explain to me, and I know he's right, that actually that influence already is proportionate, but it's very easy to suggest it's not. But I think there's a kind of bigger problem. There's a bigger problem about the trade unions and about Miliband's relationship with them. He was at the TUC. The TUC represents, or is a federation of 50-odd trade unions, of which 15 are affiliated to the Labour Party. If you look round it in the conference hall, it was not a bunch of lefties. It was not a bunch of kind of, even I felt, probably hugely political individuals. They were people who care about things that trade unions care about, which is their terms and conditions of work and being able to organise at work and employment rights and so on. And Miliband, it seems to me, or any Labour leader, has this kind of weird problem where he's obviously talking not just to the TUC and not just to Labour trade unions, but he's talking to the working class movement everywhere, and he's, of course, being watched hawkishly and with every desire to parody by a right-wing media. So I think it's a really, really hard gig for him, and it's a hard gig for any Labour leader.
Stephen Toole, as you look at this, do you feel you're intruding on private grief?
I think it's interesting. On one level, trade union reform doesn't matter in the way it used to. So I think the Blairite Clause 4 moment, every party leader now looks for that, but it's gone. That moment's gone. The trade unions are not seen as the threat they once were, and Labour doesn't need to make that symbolic break from its past in the way it did. But let's go back to where this started from, which was that Unite was trying to, in effect, buy MP representation in the next Parliament.
But they were cleared.
They were cleared of allegations of wrongdoing, but in effect they were still trying to make sure that as many of their, and they were very open about this, Len McCluskey said it quite openly in interviews, he was trying to make sure there were as many Unite-sponsored MPs after 2015 as was possible. And Ed Miliband then had to make a decision, especially if we're looking at a Parliament where it's, even if it's not hung, Labour might have a very small majority indeed. Does he want to be dependent on a handful of Unite-sponsored MPs who will be pushing a particular agenda? So this was a battle for party control. I think where he went wrong was that in 2015, he does not want to be facing a Conservative war chest of 10, 15 million if he's just agreed to waive all the trade union fees. What he should have done was try and cut a deal with Nick Clegg on party funding reform. The one thing the Lib Dems have not been able to make progress on is political reform in the last 4 years. AV gone, House of Lords gone. The one thing that we've got left was party funding reform. I think Nick Clegg would have been up for some kind of deal. Certainly Lib Dem MPs would have been up for some kind of deal that made a level playing field at the next election. But Ed Miliband didn't do that. As a result, he's made a unilateral decision to try and cut party funding. And that puts him in a very difficult position if the Conservatives don't match him, because they will have the war chest and he won't.
So he has to keep a relationship, James Milne, with the unions, but he has to calibrate that relationship very carefully. How close is he to being able to do that?
Well, obviously, the Tories aren't going to agree to the caps on spending, which I think most people would want to see in this country, because they're totally dependent on corporate and city funding on a huge scale. And that's what's the absurdity in the media coverage of this is completely missing from this story. I mean, when we're talking about trade union financial support for the Labour Party, we're talking about the donations which are governed completely by law, regulated in a way that no other sector of the population is, and certainly no company or city institution, and which is given by 3 million people who can opt out, and in some unions can not only opt out of paying the political levy, but then can opt into the Labour Party direct relationship. It varies from union to union, contrary to the way these things are reported. And that's, in my opinion, that's a good thing. It's a good thing that large numbers of people who are excluded from the political process have some direct link with it. I think Ed Miliband and the Labour leadership have to make that case. There's no concession they can make to the Daily Mail or the Murdoch press that those papers are ever going to be satisfied with, as we saw yesterday.
Not the papers, but maybe the readers, because do they need a certain proportion of Daily Mail readers to
sure, but
to
if you look at opinion
successful.
Polling, in fact, the link between the trade unions and the Labour Party is supported by a large majority of the population. It's simply not true, as has just been said, that trade unions are unpopular. And, of course, if it's presented wrongly, in my opinion, as, you know, trade union leaders, you know, ducking and diving to demand policy changes for cash, which is simply not happening, as I've just been saying. I mean, they haven't got the policies they want at all. Then people are going to be suspicious of that. But that's not the reality of it. It wasn't the reality in Falkirk. In fact, what happened in Falkirk was that Unite signed up, you know, a couple of hundred people from two large factories in the constituency to join the Labour Party and take part in a selection and try and get more working class MPs selected, and more MPs who actually reflect public opinion and their members' opinions about what should be done in politics. And that was then wrongly presented as some kind of corruption. And actually, when you go into it, I mean, I've read the report, Labour's internal report, you know, the evidence is just simply not there. It didn't happen. So Ed Miliband had to back down on that. But he's under enormous pressure, both from the Blairite wing of the Labour Party and from the media, and of course from David Cameron every week, to be seen to be standing up to these you know, terrifying trade unions who actually don't have the influence at all that they're claim to have. So I think he's got himself into a pickle, but it is possible to have a compromise negotiated solution which would save Ed Miliband's face and get some of the changes that he wants in terms of giving more individual rights to affiliated members, but at the same time maintaining the collective affiliation of trade unions to Labour Party. I think that's probably what will happen, and I think the sooner it happens, the better, because if he waits until next spring when this special conference takes place, the next 6 months for Labour are going to be constantly dogged by this question. So I think there needs to be a deal soon.
Because, Anne, there may be issues that bring the Labour Party and the unions together, and might the sell-off of Royal Mail be one of them?
Well, since the last Labour government spent quite a lot of time bizarrely trying to sell off Royal Mail, probably not, actually. I mean, that's another one of the problems that Labour hasn't ever, it seems to me, really... It's allowed itself to be kind of hamstrung by the idea that kind of all industrial action is bad industrial action, and there isn't a fight that they can where they can really side with the unions. And I know it's difficult. I know often industrial action is unpopular, but not always, and particularly not when it's very low paid people, for example. And I think that, you know, Labour does need, I could agree with Seamus, to stop being quite so scared and actually and start making a positive case for. You know, the union link. Strikes me that Labour needs the unions a heck of a lot more than the unions need Labour.
Well, I'm sure that Ed Miliband will be trying to calibrate that relationship as best he can. But we're running out of time, so let's move on. Let's talk about Boris. Good old Boris. He's a laugh, anyway. Only this week, the Mayor of London snapped, muttering bollocks to a protester who complained about fire station closures and telling a London Assembly member and former MP Andrew Dismore to get stuffed. Now, Boris apologised, but we got to thinking, when are tetchy or harassed politicians
entitled to hit back. Now, Stephen, you've been elected. You've had to face the voters. It's not always easy, is it?
It's not. Actually, facing the voters is easier because it tends to be a lot shorter space of time. I think what, you know, you move on from one doorstep to another, whereas when you're trapped in a council chamber, as I used to be, or if you're in a parliament or whatever else, sensorily deprived for hours on end, being shouted at, then chances are at some point anyone who's human will snap. And that's what Boris did. So I have some sympathy for him. It's not as strong as, you know, you look over to America, where my favourite example, actually, of invective was when Arnold Schwarzenegger sent a letter to the California State Assembly, 7-line letter with an acrostic, so that down one line it read F-U-C-K-U to the California State Assembly. You know, I think Boris is quite mild by comparison with that.
And Perkins, at least Boris didn't hit anyone. I mean, John Prescott did actually hit a voter.
He didn't hit anyone. He was called a liar, and I think, in a way, that kind of it's when you're under you're taking the abuse yourself, and you know, part of Boris's claimed charm is his you know, his just general kind of unrestrained lippiness, and you can kind of, you know, he's never been very good at engaging. He's never really needed to think very hard before he speaks because he is very clever. And he just lost it. He shouldn't have.
James, when a politician's rude, does it matter who the politician is? Because it seems that some have more licence to go close to the line than others.
Yeah, I'm a bit less generous than our other two guests on this question because it's perfectly true that in Australia or many other countries, the level of invective is far higher than what we're talking about here. But see, I don't think that he lost it at all. I think it's part of his whole deal. I mean, you know, why is Boris popular with people who wouldn't otherwise support a right-wing Tory politician like that? It's because they think he's funny and he's a laugh, exactly as you said. And so saying things like that and behaving in that is part of his appeal, his popular appeal. And so actually what was happening yesterday was that he was being questioned about closing 10 fire stations, getting rid of 15 fire engines and losing 500 jobs. He's not on top of the detail. He's not a good manager of London and executive mayor of London at all. He's just simply not across a lot of the stuff he should be. And so what does he do in those circumstances? He either makes jokes or he ends up, you know, appearing to lose it. And then people will think, oh, that's just Boris, which is part of the way he's got through this situation. But actually, when you look at his record, it's pretty dire.
But you must sometimes look at politicians who are under the cosh, either from another politician or from a member of the public, and just think they're but for the grace of God.
Sure, but I just don't think this was one of those cases at all. I think it's just a typical example of Boris trying to divert attention from what's being discussed and things that he doesn't really have good answers to at all, and trying to play to him his image and his appeal to as part of a sort of celebrity postmodern joke. Well, actually, he's forcing through some things which are pretty bad.
James, maybe you're right, maybe age has made you cynical, but we, of course, are always the height of civility. And so in that spirit, we take our leave of you, dear listener. Thanks to Seamus Milne, Anne Perkins and Stephen Tall. Our gratitude to Simon Barnard, who produced this edition. You can keep tabs on all the political developments of the week on our website. That's theguardian.com/politics. We're back next week. Until then, from me, Hugh Muir, goodbye.